episode 417 with our guest Peter Jettege, who's going to talk about globular clusters. I'm Chris, and joining me is Shane. We are amateur astronomers who love looking up at the night sky, and this podcast is for everybody who enjoys going out under the stars. Our guest today is Peter Jettege. I first met Peter when I was serving on the RASC National Council, and he co-authors the Star Cluster section of the RASC Observer's Handbook. Peter was National President of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada from 2004 to 2006, and is now a Fellow of the RASC. He is an Honorary President of the RASC London Centre. His favorite astronomical topic, both astrophysically and as an observer, is globular clusters. And lastly, Peter helped start the list of asteroids Canadians are named after, and that was our previous topic. But today we're going to talk about the globular clusters. So first off, Peter, we were just chatting in the preamble to the show. How is your eclipse experience? I understand you were not in Southwest Ontario under those clear skies, though.
Right. Hi, Chris and Shane. It's good to be back with you. My wife and I decided more than a year ago that we would head down to Texas, where the climate studies showed quite clearly that we had a better chance of clear skies for the April 8th, 2024 total solar eclipse. And it just so happens that we have some good friends whose house out in the countryside is just within a few hundred meters of the center line. And they were quite adamant about having us come down and party with them. So we went a week early. We had wonderful dinners, and we had opened a few bottles of wine before the eclipse date. And when the eclipse date came, of course, it was overcast. That happens. I'm really glad that everybody in Southwestern Ontario got to see the eclipse so beautifully. I'm hearing anecdotally that there's quite a few young persons who potentially have had their lives changed by seeing that total solar eclipse. And my wife and I, between the overcast, we did have enough sucker holes that we got to see pretty much the whole eclipse in little bits and pieces. So I'm not, you know, I'm going to chalk it up into the win column. But, you know, there is something a little more, I'm not going to say calming, because it's hard to say calm is a word to describe a total solar eclipse experience. But when we were at the 2017 eclipse in Kentucky, you know, not a cloud in the sky, and then you can kind of relax and you kind of anticipate what your procedures are going to be, kind of think it through in your mind, what you're going to look for, what sort of steps you want to follow, which all, of course, goes right out the window as soon as you start screaming when totality starts. But still, it's nice to have that as part of the experience. And whereas when you're looking through mostly overcast skies, you have this constant sinking feeling that every glimpse you get might be the last chance you see. You know, so there's a little bit more anxiety involved in that. Nonetheless, you know, as I kind of hinted, it really can be a life-changing experience to witness a total solar eclipse. And as you guys know, because you're amateur astronomers like I am, you know, it's something that occupies a corner of your mind basically every time you think about astronomy through your whole life, you know, even going back to childhood. I mean, you know, I've been interested in astronomy, I think, since I was 6 years old. And I think I probably understood how eclipses happen by the time I was maybe 8 or 10 years old. And I kind of took it for granted that eventually in my life, I would just be able to see total solar eclipses. Of course, the world was going to be set up for my convenience. So, of course, mm-hmm. I would see them. And, you know, by the time I was an adult, I realized that ain't that simple.
Exactly.
But it is worth it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Were there a lot of people down there, Peter, in the Texas area where you were, like there for the eclipse?
Yeah. You know, we drove down a week early. So, you know, even like the biggest city that's entirely within the path of totality was Indianapolis. And as we drove around Indianapolis, this is a week before the eclipse, we saw five large billboards all advertising the eclipse. How often does that happen for an astronomy event? And when we got down, we were in Central Texas. The nearest sizable town is called Kerrville. And Kerrville had like a million things going on. The city council, the parks and recreation department, schools, buses, the police force. Everybody was planning for the eclipse. They were saying that this small city of something like, I forget what the population was, but something like 30 to 50,000. They were expecting over 250,000 visitors. And I don't know
Wow.
if it turned out exactly because we did leave more or less right after the eclipse. I'd love to hear a report on these things. One of the things I was thinking that would be kind of funny would be if you added up the anticipated turnout for all of the cities and towns all along the totality of the, I think you'd probably get a total number as greater than the population of the Earth, I think. They were anticipating everybody would come to their village. So St. Thomas, Ontario thought all of 2 million folks from Toronto were all going to come. And, Aylmer thought that all 2 million folks from Toronto were going to come to Aylmer and so on down the line. And of course, that doesn't make logical sense. But when you're dealing with eclipses, it's all about emotions and your response. So pretty amazing.
Yeah, very cool.
Cool. So, in total, like how much of the eclipse did you end up seeing, Peter?
Well, that's a fair question. So, I mean, if we think of the hours of totality and partial phases, we got to see it in glimpses for maybe 30 seconds to a minute at a time, maybe 20 or 30 times. So out of the 2.5 hours of the partial phases, we saw maybe a half an hour, maybe 40 minutes. And then
Okay.
during totality in the 4 minutes and 20 seconds, something like that that we had, we probably saw another maybe five glimpses each, maybe 20 seconds, 10 seconds. So it's still about half of the eclipse. We saw Venus through a break in the clouds. If the sky had been really clear out, I had binoculars at hand. I was going to try and do a quick look around for Comet Pons-Brooks
Yeah,
because I kind of was
12P.
prepared with that.
I did read a report of a couple people who did go look, and one with 20 by 80s and didn't see it, which is a little bit surprising because I think it's at about magnitude 4.5 now. But who
Yeah.
knows? Maybe it's just not quite dark enough, even during the totality.
Yeah, that's exactly my thinking, Chris, is that even though the descriptions of eclipses almost always refer to, the sudden onset of night or
Yeah,
something like this.
midnight at daytime kind of
Yeah,
thing. Yeah.
midnight at daytime. Yeah, you're thinking of the Arthur Koestler novel.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yes, but in fact, in the actual experience, it's more like a really deep twilight.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of folks, until you actually experience an eclipse and have the whole experience, you don't really know what to expect. You don't know what parts of the verbal descriptions that people have told you to really believe.
Yeah, as well, like I know even just finding it in pretty deep twilight myself, it took me a minute or two. Well, you'd feel like you were throwing away the eclipse to spend, what could be 2 or 3 minutes, because maybe it's going to be more challenging. You'd be spending the entire eclipse trying to see the comet, which I don't know if that's a worthwhile endeavor or
Oh,
not.
right. No, you're right. That's not worth it. A quick glance is all I would have done for
Yeah,
sure.
you'd really need to have it nailed where it is, and I don't
Yeah.
know that you'd be able. I think if it was like, around 0 magnitude or something, it would be pretty easy to pick up in the binoculars. But yeah,
Right.
magnitude 4.5. I don't know how many stars could somebody see? Like when you look up in the sky, like you don't see like a sky full of stars or anything like that.
Right.
Yeah, so I don't think it's dark enough. That's my summation, but I didn't see it. We just saw the 40%, so it's all good.
Yep.
All right, let's talk about some globular clusters, Peter. We were chatting last time. I wanted to put some stuff about globular clusters in the presentation last time, but I think you're right. Why not just do another show? We've got about 100 or so shows to do a year. We got plenty of time and space to fit different topics into different shows. So, and
Well,
I think.
I think you should devote an entire hour-long show to each individual globular cluster. That would be my way of doing it.
Have we done? I don't think we've done that, but we've done a few on select items, select targets, a la Alistair Ling. He's presented, I think, a couple so far, but I don't think we've done a globular cluster. But I'm kind of with you on that. I'm kind of with you that we could do entire shows on individual objects. We could do the whole Messier catalog one year.
Yeah, never mind the rest of the Messier catalog, but even with the globular clusters, what you could do is you could do a whole hour show on each individual variable star in a globular cluster.
Whoa.
And
Sounds like we've got quite a plan in front of us, Chris.
that leads me quite naturally and smoothly into my first anecdote.
Okay.
in 1980 at the General Assembly of the RASC in Halifax. One of the presentations was by none other than University of Toronto Professor Helen Sawyer Hogg, who
Oh, yeah.
I refer to as the Grand Lady of Globular Clusters. And so there I was sitting in the audience, and it didn't actually happen this way, but in my imagination, here's what I saw and heard. This wonderful old lady steps up to the microphone. She says, 100 years of variable stars in globular clusters and year one.
Amazing.
And it went on from there. And of course, I absolutely loved her presentation. And it was great. It was wonderful to hear her and meet her and get to actually share some of what she studied.
Yeah, because she was one of the sort of leading researchers there for a period of time on the topic of globular clusters, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, from the point of view of observing the globular clusters and classifying what she observed, I don't think anybody was her equal. And she started as a young student at Harvard University, where she worked with Harlow Shapley. And between Shapley's own interest, which was considerable, and he was of course a top flight astronomy administrator as well as researcher. So between the two of them, they came up with this classification scheme, which, to be honest, I've never liked, but we can talk about that separately. The classification scheme of having the globular clusters divided by concentrations. So the more concentrated a globular cluster is, the more it's in one end of the spectrum as opposed to the other end. And they declared 12 classes. And so a lot of texts and lists, including the one that we do each year in the Observer's Handbook of the RASC, have a column where the classification by concentration is listed for each globular cluster. So she basically came up with that, and she was responsible for putting probably 100 globular clusters into their appropriate categories. And then the other side of that, which I think is quite a natural, development for her, was that she did the observations of the variable stars in many globular clusters, starting with photometry done with glass plate photographs. I don't know what her first telescope was, but I'm going to gamble that it was something at Harvard, at the Harvard College Observatory in Massachusetts. And then she spent a few years at the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory in Victoria, British Columbia. And those years are nicely covered in, again, not to jump the topic, but Peter Broughton, who is a past president of the RASC and served in many capacities in the RASC executive, he wrote a book called Northern Star, which is the biography of John Stanley Plaskett, who was the guiding light and director, the first director of the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory when it was built out there in Victoria. And so he brought Helen Sawyer Hogg to Victoria, I think it was in the 1930s.
Sorry, Peter, can I just give a small correction? Yeah, Northern Star, J.S. Plaskett by Peter Broughton, just to make sure I got it all together for people, because people do go and Google it.
Very good. Yes,
Yep.
and it's an excellent book. I my copy is signed by Peter Broughton, and I was pleased to receive it from him. And I actually only just read it this past winter. Finally got around to reading it. It's quite an engaging story of a Canadian astronomer, of course. And anyway, so having Helen Sawyer Hogg there gave her access to glass plates taken by what was, for a short time, as you probably know, the largest telescope in the world. And then for a longer time after that, the second largest telescope in the world. And so she studied the variable stars in the globular clusters that way. And later on in her career, she first of all had access to the even larger telescope at the David Dunlop Observatory outside Toronto. I got to work with some of the glass plates that she took there. And then, of course, down in Chile, starting in the 1970s, there were quite a few plates that we analyzed that were taken by one of the telescopes down there that she had organized.
The story that sticks out most to me about her work at the David Dunlop Observatory is that when she had, I'm not sure how many children she had, but anyway, she had one of her babies with her, and she would take the baby up in a basket or something into the secondary cage when she was taking those plates, and then would actually take the baby out, hold the baby, put the plate in the basket, lower the basket, and people would remove it, send the basket back up, and she'd drop the baby back in.
Wow.
That's hilarious. And it
That's a great
doesn't
story.
surprise me at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty.
Of course there were very strict rules and procedures for having ladies at the telescope, at night.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just looking up here too, just while we're on the topic of globular clusters and Helen Sawyer Hogg, HELEN, HOGG. People can look this up, but she added actually some Messier globulars. She added four Messier objects to the Messier list of 109 or 110, however you read it. But she added Messier 107, which is in Ophiuchus, as well as Messier 14 in Ophiuchus, both globular clusters, and then the galaxies M106 and M105 as well, of course, because she was a not only a great astro a great astronomer, but she was also somebody who was interested in the history of astronomy, had gone through some of Messier's original notes and stuff as well. Peter, I'm sure you know a fair bit more about that than I do.
Well, no, those are all great, great additions here, Chris. And I do remember that she wrote, I don't think it was a book, but she wrote at least one article where she talked about, her investigations into Messier's notes. And that article is where she, tossed in those extra four Messier numbers. So I think, yeah, I think you're right. I think the last couple on the Messier list really should be credited to, her, that it should be credited to her that they are on the list at all.
I'm just looking up. Just while we're chatting here, I did find her paper that you were citing. It was in the Journal of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, volume 67, page 8, called, strangely enough, "Variable Stars in Globular Clusters" by Sawyer Hogg, comma H dot. So if people want to go and read that, it's freely available online to those with access to Google.
Well, is that the article where she did, talked about the research into Messier's notes? That doesn't sound like the right title.
No, it's not. But you referred
Yeah.
to that earlier. Just while I was searching for that one, but I couldn't quickly
It might
locate.
be that this was part of a regular column that she wrote. She had a, a regular thing that she would put into the Journal of the RASC. And as you probably know, she also, for many years, wrote a, I think, weekly or maybe it was monthly, but a frequent article that appeared in one of the Toronto major mainstream newspapers. So
Yeah.
she was responsible for turning on, basically a whole generation of youngsters and citizens who would read the newspaper and learn about general astronomy from her, basically.
Yeah, one of the older articles that I used to read by her was the one, I think it was in the journal called Out of Old Books,
Yeah.
Essays of the History, because that one really inspired me, like that series. I think that was in the Journal of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada. And I've often thought about kind of doing a bit of a redo on that one, or a reboot, maybe is the best way to put it, since it's something I'm rather interested in as well. I'm just looking here.
Definitely a worthy project.
Yeah, because I'm somebody who likes to read all these old articles, and then you find stuff every once in a while. Every once in a while, I'll put a journal article out, but I'm not finding one here on the. All it says is this is from SEDS. I'm sure you're familiar with SEDS. Was that when researching globular cluster publications, Helen recovered a longly forgotten letter by Pierre Machin, and then it says Helen Sawyer Hogg Sawyer, 1948 in Bodes. Jarkbuck for 1786, in which he disclaims his discovery of M102 and lists four newly discovered deep sky objects, which she proposed to be added to the Messier. Let's see here. But it's not linking. It lists all the objects, but then it doesn't really list the article. Oh, no, wait. Yeah, actually, it was in the Out of Old Books. Helen B. Sawyer Hogg, 1947, Out of Old Books. Dash Catalogues of Nebulous Objects in the 18th Century Journal of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, volume 41, page 265 to 273, for those interested. And then as well, she wrote a follow-up one the following year, 1948, Volume 53, page 17, doesn't say, must be the same title of some sort.
Yeah, out of old books. Yeah, and you're right. That's exactly the thing that I'm talking about. That's where she listed those things. Now, and to kind of build on that, one of the things I find really interesting is the idea of who discovers a globular cluster. And let me just explain for a minute. You know, when we talk about things like discovering comets or asteroids, you look, you see it, boom, it's discovered. But with globular clusters, there's a really interesting kind of a problem involved, and that is that in the early days of telescopic observations of the night sky, folks didn't know what globular clusters were. And so you had a nebulous object in the Messier list, and Messier didn't know which ones were globular clusters, which ones were galaxies. He didn't know which ones were planetary nebulas in some cases. And he didn't know what they were in terms of astrophysics. He didn't know what those objects really were in space. And so he just reported them, you know, as nebuleuses sans étoiles, you know, and that's all he had to say. And so it might be a fair thing. And I've wondered about this myself, and I've done a little bit of work about this. The, you know, who actually discovered a globular cluster? Was it Messier when he just didn't know what it was? Or was it later? And in many cases, it's either William or John Herschel who went through the list and looked at those things and said, oh yeah, that's got stars in it. That's a globular cluster. And so they would get credit for it. And so I can actually talk about one case in particular. This is another kind of fascinating, cute little anecdote. So in the case of not one of the Messiers, this is NGC 5694. That's in the new general catalog. And you know, that NGC catalog was built up, you know, through the 19th century, compiled by Dreyer, and then, you know, worked on by others as well. And the idea with the new general catalog was it was supposed to be kind of the last word. It was supposed to be a compilation of what other folks had put in various catalogs that all used various systems for numbering and so on. And what Dreyer wanted to do was to have one scheme for all of them. So NGC 5694 got dumped into that list, into Dreyer's catalog. But nobody who had observed it prior to Dreyer's putting it in his list called it a globular cluster. And Dreyer himself didn't call it a globular cluster. In Dreyer's notes, it doesn't say. Well, I mean, now if you look at it in the modern world, people, of course, have written in that it's a globular cluster, but Dreyer didn't know that. And in fact, the first person who identified it as a globular cluster was none other than Clyde Tombaugh, the American astronomer down at Lowell Observatory, who is famous for having discovered Pluto. And I knew this. I had been through the list of the NGC objects, and, you know, for the globular clusters, I kind of, you know, made a note of who it was claimed had observed them in the past and who identified it. And so I was aware that Clyde Tombaugh had, you know, been the first person who recognized that NGC 5694 was in fact a globular cluster. And everything's going along, perking along fine in my life. And then it was the 1991 Texas Star Party, which was the first time I actually met Clyde Tombaugh. He was there as a guest of honor. And he was a real sport, even though he was already quite an elderly gentleman. He was a real sport. Even late at night, he was out there wandering around the observing field, chatting with folks, you know, making his presence known and looking through telescopes. The telescope I had was one that I had borrowed from David Levy. We'd brought it with us from Tucson, but it was a 20-centimeter Newtonian Dobson mounted telescope. And so I was sitting there on the field, and I was just spending the evening looking at globular clusters, and I heard Clyde's voice. And he was coming my direction, talking to other folks. And so what I did was I quickly turned my telescope to NGC 5694. And as Clyde walked by, I greeted him and I asked him if he'd like to have a view of the globular cluster, you know, his globular cluster, because he's the one who identified it. And of course, he, you know, gave me a little cackle. He had a voice, and he came over and he looked through the telescope and he wrote in my observing log that this was the first time he had ever seen NGC 5694 actually through a telescope. That,
What?
yeah, his discovery
Wow.
had been made on photographic plates, of course,
Right.
while he was searching for Pluto.
Huh.
And, you know, the actual plate that had 5694 on it, because it's, you know, it's in the plane of, or not exactly in the plane of the ecliptic, but it's in the zone that you'd be searching for if you're looking for planet Pluto. So, you know, that in his notes that he took that for that specific plate, it says, globular cluster, and basically points to it. And that's the proof that he was the person who identified it. And basically, that was the only time he ever observed it. He had other things to do, and he had a busy life. He was a teacher at University of New Mexico, and or actually, sorry, New Mexico State University. So in any case, he went through his whole life and never ever made the effort to go back and actually look at that object through a telescope until that night in 1991 when he and I happened to meet up together to do that. I thought that was pretty cool.
That's another great story. I love it.
So, just for people's reference, NGC 5694 is also known as Caldwell 66.
Oh, I hate those
And
Caldwell numbers.
yeah, I know a lot of people. I'm putting that in for Alan Whitman. I hope he
Oh,
listens
does
to
Alan
this.
Whitman like? I'll have to speak with him about
No,
that.
he absolutely does not like them. This is in jest, right? I'm not.
All right. Okay,
I that would be a total. Oh, Chris
well, you can
Beckett
add
says
me to that list of folks you can tease about the Caldwell number.
So then, no, I think Alistair Ling is a fan. No, he's not either. I think we did a whole show on that. But this NGC 5694 is pretty far out into the sort of galactic halo, I think. Formed 12 billion years ago, and perhaps extra galactic in origin, being captured by the Milky Way. So, Peter, I got a question. Maybe you don't know the maybe this isn't a fair question, but how can these globular clusters be like 95% the age of the known universe? Because isn't the universe only like 14 billion years old or something, and these globular clusters are hanging out at around 12 billion years? I thought the lifespan of stars just wasn't such that they would be able to live that long.
Well, Chris, you're like a fish on the end of a hook here because that's one of my absolute favorite questions, of course.
Right.
In the 1970s when I was a undergraduate, the age of the universe in textbooks was described as being somewhere between 10 and 20 billion years. And that's the best they could do at the time. And then usually a decent textbook would have a little either an asterisk or a little parenthetical remark that the globular clusters were known to be in the range of 12 to 13 billion years old, which seemed to make it rather difficult to imagine the younger age of 10 billion years for the universe that some evidence did point to. And I thought this was really highly amusing back in the 1970s. And the reason that we're so confident about the age of the globular clusters is because it's the study of the variable stars in the globular clusters that have told us probably the most about stellar evolution, how stars actually go through a process of evolving over many, many billions of years. And if you draw charts of the characteristics of the stars in a globular cluster and use the variable stars to fill in the gaps there in those charts, you can actually get a fairly reliable measure of the age of that globular cluster. And it always comes out to something like around 12 billion years. It's almost not even worth making a separate note, although in the modern world, in the 21st century, things are getting much more subtle. But by, in the mid-1970s, basically all globular clusters had an age listed of something around 12 billion years. And there were an awful lot of interesting technical things that could be studied, but that was kind of the attached wisdom. So we were pretty confident that that we knew the age of the globular clusters even 50 years ago, and our view of the rest of the universe has gotten much more refined since then, but the globular clusters still have that kind of interesting place in the big picture that they are that old. And that makes it really quite fascinating. And I've always found that really quite a wonderful aspect of the study of globular clusters.
Yeah, I'm quite interested in them myself. Actually, I got up this
I know you
morning.
are.
I was out doing a little observing, taking a look at M10, M11. Actually, the first thing I wanted to look at was M4, and then I was taking a look at that the other little. I got the 12 by 36 binoculars. I could just barely get NGC 6144 there as
Yeah.
well. But yeah, I took a look at quite a few.
In between M4 and Antares,
Yeah, that's what sort of
that's
at
what.
an isosceles type triangle above above the both of them.
Yeah, that little that the little I say little globular
It's just
cluster,
faint, yeah.
NGT6144, is kind of on a challenge list, but it's an interesting comparison to M4. I mean, M4, if it weren't for the fact that we're seeing it through the Milky Way's,
Dust, yeah.
gas and dust, and if it weren't for the fact for us that it's a fairly south object, we usually just see it, heaving itself over the horizon, basically. If it weren't for those two facts, M4 would certainly be the most spectacular cluster. It's a bigger cluster than M13 and would be brighter, I'm sure, if we had a better aspect on it. And then NGC 6144 is actually not all that much different in terms of angular size. It's not as bright,
Yeah,
but
it's
folks
faint,
tend to
yeah.
think of it as a small globular cluster, but it's really not. And so it's an interesting comparison in itself. And what I often do, and again, not to kind of move the topics along too quickly here, but I like to kind of put the globular clusters in three, in triples. So there's a hard one, an easy one, and a medium one, and I try and group them together. Generally speaking, I do this with individual constellations. And in Scorpius, the third one, which is the medium one of the three, is M80.
And the idea just
It's a
north of
little
there.
farther up the up
Yeah.
the towards the claws of the Scorpion, but it's easily found when you're looking at M4. And if you do make the effort to look at NGC 6144, which I think is probably beyond most novice observers. So someone who's looking at their Messier list and does M4 and then goes up to M80 can be forgiven for skipping over NGC 6144. They're going to come back to
Oh. Oh,
later.
it's tough. Yeah. I mean, how many times did I even went trying observing for it many times before I saw it. But then once you see it, it's hard to unsee
Right, exactly. And the other thing that makes me laugh about that pair, M4 and NGC 6144, you often see folks will photograph that region of the sky because of the colored gas clouds that are in there. The ga
Yeah.
colored glass clouds are gas clouds are associated with Rho Ophiuchi, which is just a hop
Yeah.
skip jump north of Antares.
Yeah, it's a triple
And
star, I think, or something like
yeah,
that.
it is. It's a triple star, exactly. And I'm not sure how much of the gas really actually belongs to Rho Ophiuchi. But what'll often happen is you'll see folks will take this incredible, astrophotographers will spend a huge amount of data on the Rho Ophiuchi region. And they end up with these blue and yellow, clouds with all these dark shapes running through them. And they forget to point out that Antares is right there in the picture. And so is M4. And if they've done a decent job, the first thing I always look for, well, I guess I'm bent this way, but the first thing I look for when someone shows me a photograph of the Rho Ophiuchi region, I try and see if they've picked out NGC 6144. If their picture shows that, then I think they did a good job on the picture. I don't care how much work they did, it's wonderful, but how much work they did on the blue and the yellow and the orange gas clouds, I want to see that globular cluster.
I really failed last night. I got up and I even had this in the back of my mind yesterday, but it's kind of chaotic getting this place up and running. And I went out and I neglected to look at NGC 5897 and M5. I walked out the door at 3:20 in the morning, which is the exact moment when these culminate at the meridian, which is rare because this is like you have only a few weeks to catch these when they're at the meridian because
Yeah.
either they're in morning twilight or they're in evening twilight. It's a very narrow window here of only a matter of weeks, not even a month, I think, that you can get them. So I'm hoping we get another clear night, fingers crossed, here in the next few weeks, because that NGC 5897, which is an eighth magnitude, 8.5 magnitude globular cluster rate between Zubin Eskamalia and Zubin El-Janubi, if I'm just calling this up off the top of my head, there in Libra, is one of my favorite globular clusters. However, there's like years that can go by where you can't get it when it's at the meridian. Just you'd never get the right night. So
Yeah,
last night was the night and I totally messed it up.
that's interesting you say that. Yeah, I didn't really I don't observe it any on a regular basis. It is kind of a thin globular cluster. So I can again forgive folks if they don't, put it on their regular observing program. You say you have been observing it regularly.
Yeah, like whenever, like every year when I can,
Often.
I do try to make an observation. I was really
What
negligent
makes it
this
your
morning.
favorite?
Well, it's actually
One of
fairly
your,
bright. Yeah,
you think, oh, okay.
yeah, like 8.5 magnitude. Like if you look at it compared to these other ones we're talking about, I can pick that up really just about as easy as M80. It's within a magnitude of M80, really. So it's not a very faint cluster. I'm just trying to see which Messier it is closest to. It's probably out of all these ones, it's probably most similar maybe to maybe like M9 or something like that. It's
Well,
pretty
those are
close.
good comparisons. I hadn't really thought about it that way. I always thought of it as fairly thin, just because you, I maybe I'm thinking only of the, the glass plate photography that we had from the 1970s, but you can pretty much see right through it.
Yeah, but you can see it in binoculars. It's sort of a remarkable little one. But I haven't done a sketch of it yet. I really wish I'd brought my scope out. It wasn't supposed to be clear last night, and it was just like the opportunity presented itself and I went out and I did observe four or five other globular clusters, so I didn't do too bad knowing that we would be chatting today. But anyway, I'm rambling on here. But I just think that this is the time of year if people are going out observing to try to get people should take a look for NGC 5897 as well as for M5, because they are lying on the meridian, while it's still dark in the early morning hours. This is when you want to go out to be observing them.
Yeah, that's good. Of course, NGC 5897, we didn't just pull that out of a hat. That's a globular cluster that Helen Sawyer Hogg studied back in the 1950s. So there were four variable stars in it that she discovered with her photography. And then in the later 1950s, at Palomar Observatory, Alan Sandage added three more variable stars. So there were seven that were known at the time around, the turn of the 1970s when I came into the picture. And 5897 was studied here at Western University, where, in my town here in London, Ontario, by a professor named Amelia Waylaw. And when I was an undergrad at the end of my second year, she hired me for the summer as a research assistant. And that was the cluster that she wanted to analyze for that summer. So I got involved both on the observational end, because we went out to the Elgin-Field Observatory near London and took photographs of 5897. And it's interesting, I'm trying to think this through in my head as when you were talking with us a second ago, that it's on the meridian now in April. We were observing it in, June and July.
Oh, it's low.
So it's going to be a fair bit different
Yeah.
already. And because it's in the south, it's in, as you mentioned, it's in Libra. So it's not all that high up off the horizon, higher than Antares and M4 we were just talking about a couple of minutes ago, but not much higher. And I find that remembering back, looking back at the glass plates we took with the 1.2 meter telescope there at Elgin Field, they looked very grainy and foggy compared to the pictures that were loaned to us by Helen Sawyer Hogg that were taken down in Chile,
Do you
in
still
the
have those?
desert. Well, I mean, I still have them in my mind. The glass plates, I'm sure that the University of Toronto collection would have the glass plates from Chile, and
Sorry, I meant the ones that you took.
yeah, I don't have them in my possession.
Oh,
No,
okay.
we, they're part of the university's collection of plates. What I did, what Professor Whalow had access, of course, to the resources of the university, and she had taken a large scale photographic print, so a piece of photographic paper about maybe, I don't know, 50 centimeters by 50 centimeters, so like the size of a computer screen, a nowadays computer screen. And she had the photographic technician at Western U back then make a print of one of these photographic plates. And I have that photographic print.
Oh,
And
cool.
that's one of the things where I kind of get the image, and just comparing it to other photographs of globular clusters that I love. It's not a color print. We're talking about a reverse black and white, where the stars are dark splotches on a white or gray background. And in that photograph, the reason that we did that, the reason that Professor Whalow gave me that print in the first place, was that we had circled on it the seven variable stars that Helmsayre, Hogg, and Allen Sandage had discovered, which is the stars that we were going to study that summer.
Cool.
So I had them circled, and I still have that poster basically on the wall in our basement here in London, Ontario today with the variable stars circled. And just to be complete about it, because I know you like to say some of your listeners are going to look these things up.
Oh, yeah.
There were a few other variable stars added in the 1990s, and then in, I think it was, well, 2000, in the early 2000s. So I think they're up to something like 11 or even 14 variable stars now in NGC 5897. But there were only seven when I was a student and a research assistant in the summer of 1975. And so the great experience for me, and, you know, if I had managed to continue on and have a career as a research astronomer, that really would have been my first footprints. That would have been what I started. I would have probably studied NGC 5897 all of my professional career, because there's an awful lot of cool things you can do. And other researchers have done those things and published and so on. But the fun part of the story for us, there's two aspects of it. One is taking the photographs. So you're sitting up there in the old days before CCD cameras and before stacking images. You know, you're sitting up there in the telescope dome. It's a summer night, so it's not particularly cold, but somebody had to actually guide the telescope. So I'm sitting under the 1.2 meter telescope with a little tiny, you know, a little slice guider. So the frame of the glass plate is a rectangle, but of course the field of view of the telescope is a circle. And in that little tiny, you know, crescent shaped sliver at the edge that wasn't in the photograph, but was in the field of view, the telescope was set up with a little tiny finder that was looking at that little area. So I would guide these pictures for, I think the photographs we took were somewhere in the 20 minute to half hour range. And then I would go into the dark room and actually, you know, develop them right there on the spot at night. And that way we'd have, in the morning, we'd have four or five or six, maybe, plates that to add to the collection. And there's some crazy stories there. Being an observer in a professional observatory, I was not a professional. I was just a young student, but I got to, you know, rub shoulders with this big telescope, and that was quite wonderful. But the real fun for me started when the plates came back into campus, and I had to sit in the basement, sitting in front of a machine called an electronic balancing variable iris diaphragm photometer. I learned to say that real quick. And I had to measure these plates. And, you know, this gave rise to all kinds of fun little stories. I'd be sitting there in the basement. And so the idea behind a variable iris diaphragm photometer is it was a machine about the size of a bar fridge. And inside it had, you know, lamps and motors and gewirkins inside there. And in fact, the one that we had at Western U, what did actually have a photometer inside, not a CCD, but the old style of an actual photo tube. And on top of the machine, on the horizontal surface at the top of this bar fridge sized thing, there was a stage. So you would put this glass plate. The glass plates were something like 10 by 15 centimeters rectangular, and there'd be a frame there. So you'd put the glass plate in the frame, lock it down, and then there'd be little, you know, gears that you could turn so that the plate would move left and right, up and down, well, forward and back, left and right. And there'd be a lamp shining through the plate, and you could move the plate so that the lamp would shine through any particular star on that particular plate, and that light would go down into the machine, and then it would be projected on this screen on the front of the machine. And so I'd be sitting there staring at this screen, moving the plate around, picking out the individual stars. And there was a diaphragm, so a round circle in the middle of this screen that faced me. And you had to move the star you were studying to the center of this diaphragm. Now, the diaphragm opened and closes. And in other versions of this machine that I've read about, the operator, me, would have to make the motion, make the adjustment of the diaphragm themselves. But ours was electronically balanced. So what happened was that diaphragm always would open and close so that it would admit the exact same amount of light into the detector. And so if you would put a star image, which a star image was a dark blotch, into the center of the diaphragm had to open more to get more light. And what you would do then, he was write down the reading of the opening of the diaphragm. And you did that for maybe 20 or 30 or even 40 stars on the plate in the globular cluster. And then you would chart those 40 stars on a graph. And of those 40 stars, all but seven of them were standard stars with known pre-measured, you know, well-established, heavily studied numbers for their actual brightness. So you knew how to relate the actual brightness of the star with the diaphragm setting on the machine. So you draw a graph, and the graph would have a line on it where the brighter stars required a bigger iris opening and the dimmer stars required a smaller opening. Other way around, I think. Anyway, point is you'd have this graph, and then you would put the variable stars whose actual brightness you wanted to find out. You'd plot those by the diaphragm opening and see where they fit on that curve. And that was how we measured the brightnesses of those variable stars. And that was sort of the standard technique for measuring brightnesses of variable stars all through the 1950s, 60s, and well into even the early 1980s before CCDs came around. So I spent basically almost the whole summer sitting in the basement doing that, measuring these stars, plotting literally on a piece of graph paper with a sharp pencil, how the individual plates turned the brightness of the little gray blotches into the brightness of the actual stars in the sky. Then I would enter the data into computer cards. Remember the old Hollerith cards? And I would type them in, and then I would submit them as a batch with a little group of cards that had the program that analyzed them to the computing center. And then I'd go home. That would be my day's work. And then I'd come in the next morning and walk over to the computing center and pick up the results, basically. And so what we were looking for, what Helen Sarah Hogg was looking for, what Professor Amelia Whalow here at Western U was looking for, was to find the brightness of those variable stars each and every night. These are RR Lyra type stars whose brightness varies in about a day's time, somewhere between 10 and 30 hours sort of thing. And so you would be trying to figure out what the period of these variable stars were. The period then could be used by theoretical analysis to tell you what kind of star and where they were, where that star was in its evolutionary process. And that was the whole point, of course, to try and understand the variable stars in the context of the globular cluster and the globular cluster in the context of the history of the galaxy and the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I mean, it's a great memory for me to think that it's, you know, getting close almost 50 years ago now. And, you know, that would have been my professional career if I'd been a professional astronomer.
Wow. Very, very cool. But you ended up being more of a philosopher, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. That kind of life led me that way, shall we put it? But I do. And in terms of philosophical aspects, you know, thinking about what the variable stars tell us about the globular clusters, what the globular clusters tell us about the galaxies, what the galaxies tell us about the universe, that becomes a philosophical question, right? Where do we all come from? Where is this universe going? I love those questions. And you're right. I ended up basically spending more time studying that than measuring more variable stars.
You and me both. So on that note, where do globular clusters come from?
Well, I wish I knew the answer to that. Really great. I mean, when I read the modern research, of course, you know, the real answer to your question is very technical. And it's definitely beyond me to understand the full impact of all these, you know, research results that have been coming out of the Hubble Space Telescope the last 30 years. And the idea of the accelerating universe, you know, has to somehow include the globular clusters. The really big thing, I think, in our recent, let's say in the current generation, dare I say, I'm now of the older generation, but, you know, in the current generation, the really interesting thing is the idea of galaxy mergers. So when galaxies merge, they don't necessarily destroy each other. In fact, the result of galaxy mergers is often something that looks like what we think a galaxy should look like. And so it's kind of coming to the point where I almost think that what we think a galaxy really simply is actually not going to be involved in a future merger, but is actually the result of a past merger. And so this wonderful spiral shape that we think of as a classic grand design galaxy, it's just as likely to be the result of a merger rather than the impactor going in. And so those globular clusters, my guess, and I mean, I've tried to read some of the research on these papers, my guess is that the globular clusters formed separately, but close to galaxies, which then formed mergers, and the globular clusters survived the mergers. Now, maybe there were other globular clusters that were disrupted, and maybe they had, sort of they turned into streams of stars that then got kind of sucked into long shapes involving the galaxy mergers. We do see evidence of this. In fact, I guess it was just last year or the year before in the Observer's Handbook, where we have our yearly take on globular clusters and open clusters, we actually did a profile of M92, Messier 92, in the
That's
constellation
this year.
Perseus.
That's this
That's
year, I
this
think, is
year's.
yeah.
So, and it's now associated with a stream of stars that is connected with the original evolution of the Milky Way galaxy. So I think that's an interesting concept. It kind of makes sense to me, and I would love to hear professional researchers talk about and expand on this, the idea that the globular clusters were involved with, but sort of beside the formation of the galaxies as they originally started. So what way I'm looking at it in my mind, it's the globular clusters even predate the galaxies.
So on that note, these are some of the things that I like to think about as well. So are the stars which globular clusters are comprised of, are these just really old stars? Would the stars themselves be 12 billion years, or is there a whole stellar evolutionary cycle that's taking place inside of globular clusters to allow them to exist into the billions of years of the epoch?
I think that's pretty much exactly the way I thought of it in the 1970s, and I don't think it's changed too much since then. The idea is that we're seeing stars in the globular clusters that are old, and they are literally that old. So they're more reddish stars, and they when you look at the actual chart that shows them, all of the stars that were bigger, more massive stars in the early parts of the spectral classifications, those stars have already evolved off the main sequence. And that's where the variable stars come in. So the stars that are the really oldest ones that are still on the main sequence are in the FKG part of the stellar classifications. And all of the O and the B and the A stars have evolved off that and are in stages of their development where they are variable stars. That's why the variable stars are important to observe. But yeah, so the answer to your question is those stars in those globular clusters are that old.
And why do the globulars hang out in the halo? So with the open clusters, they tend to be right in the sort of the central band of the Milky Way. How come the globulars sit in the halo? They sort of surround the Milky Way. You can go out any time of year and see them. There's a few that we see in the Milky Way proper, but is this just because they're slowly being captured as the Milky Way absorbs other galaxies? Why are they in the halo?
Yeah, I think the last little bit is maybe a little bit too far, too large of a scale. But the first thing you said there, it is what I understand the correct idea. We shouldn't really associate open clusters and globular clusters together. They're a different kettle of fish. Sure, the same rules govern the development of individual stars, but how those stars form together into clusters is a different story for open clusters. And as you pointed out, the open clusters are concentrated in the plane of the galaxy. They're an actual phenomenon related to the disk of a galaxy, whereas with the globular clusters, they're around in the halo. And I think that's connected to what I was just describing, that they are in fact sort of separate from the evolution of the galaxy. They hang around the galaxy just because they're connected with it by tidal forces, gravity, but they aren't necessarily bound to it. Unless they just happen to be that particular case. You mentioned, that at least one of the globular clusters we talked about, NGC 5694, might in fact not belong to the Milky Way. I think it probably does. famously back in the early days, 100 years ago, Harlow Shapley referred to the NGC, what is it, 2419, if I'm getting the number right. He referred to it as the interstellar, the intergalactic tramp.
Oh, this is the one up in Lynx.
Yeah, exactly. And he was pretty sure that it didn't belong to the Milky Way galaxy, and I think he was right.
2419. Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah.
2419. So
Caldwell 25 for Alistair. Yeah, sir.
very good. So yeah, and that's another one that's a fun one to observe. It's well away from the plane of the Milky Way, so it's in a good spot in the night sky to see. And it's such a distant object that, it's very dim, and that makes it quite an interesting and challenging thing to look at. So yeah, so the idea is that the globular clusters are in the halo because they didn't form with the galaxy. They formed around, they formed separately and then joined up and around the galaxy.
I just want to give Shane a second to hop in. Sorry, I've been kind of rambling.
No, keep going. It's good.
Peter, what's your favorite globular cluster? We're getting towards the end here. Do you have a favorite set of favorites, southern, northern hemisphere?
Yeah, I think it kind of depends on what mood I'm in. I mean, NGC 5897 is my favorite because of that personal connection, that I got to kind of be on, the closest thing I ever did to professional astronomy research was that one. In terms of observing them, everybody, of course, talks about M13, Messier 13, and Hercules being, the most beautiful object in the northern sky that we can see in the summertime. And I don't dispute that. But what I like to do is look at M13 together with the other two globular clusters that are in Hercules, which are Messier 92 and NGC 6229. They again fall into this little triplet kind of rule that I was talking about. Ken Hewitt-White wrote about this in Sky News some years ago. M13 being a bright globular cluster, M92 not being particularly bright, but still relatively easy. And then 6229 is a bit of a challenging object. And all three of them are up there in the top half of Hercules. So it kind of makes a nice little thing to bounce back and forth. That's one of my favorite targets to do. The M3 in Boötes, I find it doesn't have any kind of features. It's just got stars. And I kind of love that. It's just kind of a uniform spread of stars. And I really love that. Near an M3 in Boötes, just across the border, I forget which the constellation that's next door is,
Coma. Coma.
NGC 5466.
Yeah, isn't that in Coma? Berenice.
That could be. That sounds right. And if you star hop from M3 in Boötes to NGC 5466, you get to learn that little pattern of star hop, click, click, click. There you are. And 5466, much more challenging object.
Oh, it's still in Boots.
Is it? Okay, so it's near the border,
Oats.
right?
Yeah, it's right on the border. There's another one across the border, though,
Yeah,
too, I
and
think.
there's two in Coma Berenices, NGC 5053 and M53. And I can never remember which one of those two I kind of go to next, but I always like going from M3 to 5466. So I remember seeing 5466 with a Celestron 5. What is that, 120 millimeters or something? From the front porch at the Stellafane convention in Vermont one summer. Took the C5 with us, dragged it up the hill, set it up on the porch, and I just happened to have done that star hop a couple nights before, in a different location. So I remembered, okay, M3 is easy to find, and click, 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 and boom, I had 5466 right there in a fairly small telescope, in a wonderful community environment with all these amateur astronomers at the famous astronomy star party convention kind of thing. That was a great memory as well. So
How
I think
many?
if somebody asked me, and you just did,
Yeah.
what's my favorite globular cluster, I'll say M3. It's
How
the
many
prettiest.
have you observed?
All of them. So there, that one of the things, one of the reasons I like globular clusters as a topic for study is that it's a manageable list. With open clusters, there's thousands of them, variable stars, thousands of them, galaxies, thousands of them. You're never going to get to the end of them. But with globular clusters, the Milky Way galaxy has something like 150 globular clusters. of those 150, something like 50 or 55 of them are, too obscured. They're behind the Milky Way's bulge, or just plain too difficult to see, like Palomar 9 or something like that. There's about a dozen Palomar globular cluster, and I think I've only seen one of those.
Probably Palomar 5 by whatever it is in
Yeah, maybe,
Sagittarius,
yeah,
yeah.
Pal 5 might be the one I've seen. So, of the 91 or 95 globular clusters that you can actually see, with starting with a small telescope on the Messier list, and then you go to a bigger telescope, working your way through the NGC list, couple of IC objects that are not on the NGC list, and of course many of them are in the southern sky. So I've been to the southern hemisphere just once, went to Chile and basically bagged all the globular clusters that you can see with a 50 centimeter telescope down there. So basically all of the globular clusters that a visual observer can expect to see, I've seen all of those. And I
Palomar
guess, like I say,
nine.
it's
Sorry.
nice to have a manageable list.
Palomar nine is the one I'm thinking of. But yeah, I'm just looking at a Sky and Telescope article from 8 years ago. It lists like 157.
Yeah, and that includes
Which,
all those. There's quite a
yeah.
few of them that were discovered in the infrared,
Yeah.
because the dust of the Milky Way doesn't interfere with infrared light as much as it does with visible light. So if you tune your telescope to infrared and look through the dust of the Milky Way, you can often see what's behind the dust, and is otherwise invisible. And so quite a few of those, I'll even say maybe even as many as maybe two dozen of the globular clusters that Sky and Telescope would put on that list of 157 would be globular clusters that are really only visible to, a large telescope looking with an infrared camera, infrared filter, and you're not going to see them with your own eye, even through the biggest telescope.
Nice. Well, I think we're getting towards the end here now. I want to go take a look at Palomar 9 again. That's a nice one. That's easy to see. It's right beside.
I didn't find it easy to see, but yeah,
No?
it's definitely one you should go for. For folks who consider themselves developing, if you start off, you're a beginner and you want to become an observer in astronomy, sure, you might be interested in all the topics. Fine. I'm only going to talk about the globular clusters. So for a beginner, there's a really good workable set of objects that a beginner can see almost like the very first night. And you can really whet your appetite. You can start honing your skills by looking at those targets over and over and over again. And as you get to be a better observer, you get to handle, maybe you get a chance to work with a bigger telescope. So then you start to go down the list of the globular clusters in terms of brightness, and up the list in terms of challenge. And you get into more and more challenging objects. And basically, by the time you get to looking at things like Palomar 9, you are an accomplished, advanced, amateur observer in astronomy. That basically covers the whole range.
I really like Palomar 9 because it's been probably 10 years since I first observed it, maybe even longer.
So, can you actually remember your view of it in your head after 10 years?
Oh, yeah, because
That's excellent. I can't do
it's
that.
right by that star V, whatever it is, V1, V2 Sagittarii. And to my mind, the first time I looked at it was through a 5-inch astrophysics. And then that's really what made me want to get a 5-inch Apochromat. And then when I got my 5-inch Apochromat, I spent a lot of nights looking at it. Because it almost looks like this little chandelier right beside that new two or V1 V2 Sagittarii. I can like that's one of the globulars, like that's the most obscure globular that really sits out in my mind. I could probably almost draw it, but I observed it a lot over a few years there. Yeah, because that's really what put me over the one of the objects that put me over the edge to get a really good 5-inch Apochromat.
See, I think even just your description in these short words, anybody who's an astronomer anywhere in the world listening to you describe that would know that's exactly the kind of experience and the way of putting it. That's what makes you, an advanced observer in amateur astronomy. That's what you got to get up to do that.
Maybe.
That's amazing. Yeah.
It's an addiction. Yeah, I was out last night. That's why I'm kind of bagged here a bit today, but it's all good. It's all good. Anything to hop in with here towards the end, Shane, before we let Peter go?
No, that's everything. Thanks again, Peter, for coming on the
Oh,
show.
thank you, Shane, for offering me the opportunity to talk about a topic I love.
Really enjoyed having you on, Peter. I don't think we hit half of, we didn't even have that many notes, and a lot of this stuff was sort of, I don't know, serendipitous or whatever. As an observer, I'm quite interested in globulars, so I find it to be a fairly easy and very passionate topic for me as well. So it's always a lot of fun to talk to somebody else who's into this stuff as well.
Well, thanks for saying that.
I may as well give the outro before I fall asleep here. Concluding message, please subscribe, share the show with the other stargazers you know. Send us your show ideas, observations, and questions to actualastronomy@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the show. If you are interested in more information, would like to contact us, or if you would like to support the podcast, check out our website, actualastronomy.com. Thank you.